From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm David Strever, guest hosting for Evan Dawson. Our connection today was made in a basement in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin in the 1960s. Dave Arneson was visiting his friend Gary Gygax, and they were talking about their favorite pastime, wargaming. The two had met at conventions where people used miniatures and elaborate boards to play out simulations of famous battles. Imagine being Napoleon and winning at Waterloo. The friends came up with the new idea. It took them a couple of years, but they went on to publish Dungeons & Dragons in 1974. Instead of historical battles and reenactments, players took on the role of fantasy stereotypes or archetypes, elves and halflings, wizards and warriors, while another player, the Dungeon Master, would simulate the world the characters interacted with. The hobby has changed a lot since those early days when it was primarily inspired by classic pulp fantasy like Conan and the high fantasy books of J.R.R. Tolkien like The Lord of the Rings. And role-playing itself changed. It went from a single game to an industry. We've had the mainstream titan, Dungeons & Dragons, has been made into movies, video games, and then there are tons of independent and alternative versions of the core concept. And many of the people who played it back in the 70s still play it today. We're actually celebrating the 50th year of Dungeons & Dragons. I'm really excited to do this show today because, like millions of adults, I play role-playing games with friends and family members, and I have a whole panel here of people who want to talk about why they play, the benefits of gaming, and how you can get started. On my left here, I have Sean Boyle. He is the Principal Lecturer of Interactive Games and Media at RIT. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
I have, right next to him, I have Ira Brand, who works locally in game development publishing. I'll ask you to talk more about what you actually do later. Thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
And then Ben Doran, who's also a game publisher under the title Vonware.
Zonware.
Zonware, that's right. You're good. And then I have John Paul Dyson. He is the Senior Vice President for Exhibits and Interpretive Resources at the Strong National Museum of Play. And he just helped put together their new exhibit, Dungeons & Dragons, 50 Years of Storytelling. Thank you so much for being here, JP.
Excited to be here.
Can we actually start with the exhibit at the Strong? I haven't been there yet, but my five-year-old daughter, who also plays role-playing games, and I are super excited. I think we're going to go there this weekend. What inspired it? What brought it about?
Well, certainly the 50th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons was a big factor. It's such a huge game, not only in tabletop gaming, but also in video games, too. It's inspired so many video games, and it opened a whole new way of playing with role-playing games. So we thought, you know what? We have this amazing collection of Dungeons & Dragons materials. We need to showcase it. And like all our exhibits at the Strong, we try to feature not only the exhibits themselves, the artifacts themselves, but also fun interactives and the history behind what happened. So a chance to bring that all together. We have good connections with Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast. And so we're able to work with them to bring an exhibit to life.
What's the oldest Dungeons & Dragons artifact in the collection?
Well, if you go before Dungeons & Dragons, you can go back to a book, say, by H.G. Wells, the science fiction author, which is called Little Wars, which introduced this idea of playing with miniature soldiers, as you talked in the intro. And that was a good way for people to bring these worlds to life. We have things in the exhibit, for instance, like the earliest draft of Dungeons & Dragons, before it actually became a published game. We have newsletters from the 60s and 70s, where people like Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson, the creators whom you referenced, beginning to flesh out these ideas. And so what we can show is the prehistory, the origins of the game, and then how it's changed over the years and brought so many different variants to life, both in D&D and also in other role-playing games.
You've had people there playing, right? You've had a couple nights for D&D players to come out?
Yeah, last night we had hundreds of people at the event itself and at the museum. It was an adults-only night. We also have stuff for kids, too, as well, to learn how to play D&D, to paint miniatures, do all those things that are associated with the game itself. We have a happiest hour coming up soon for adults only, so I'm sure there'll be a lot of D&D fans there for that, too.
And that's running until January, correct?
Yep, January 5th. So this is a limited time option for this one. Many of our exhibits, when we open them, are permanent exhibits. This is a temporary one. So if you're a D&D fan, I would come soon.
Excellent. That's awesome. That's great to hear. Let me get my other notes. Why do you think, this is for anyone here who wants to jump on it, why, outside of this 50th year, why is D&D having such a big moment right now, right? We had the major movie with Chris Pine and you know, lots of big name actors. Baldur's Gate as a video game. If you're not familiar with video games, it's, I think, game of the year and maybe the best selling game of the year when it came out. What's anyone want to take a stab at this one?
I mean, I'll say, you know, one of the big ones is Stranger Things. Back when the first season of that dropped, that really sort of brought around a revival in D&D, but also other RPGs as well.
Yeah, I think specifically Stranger Things did kind of put a spotlight on Dungeons & Dragons itself. But I think, I mean, we've also seen this in like board games has been really, really big lately. And I think one of the things is that everyone has had like 10 years to like not talk to their friends. Like we've made every possible solution to like not see anyone in the past 10 years. And then I think recently like people started playing games again and were like, oh, and I like going over to my friend's house and like playing games with them and actually talking in person and having that thing. So I think that's why it's just getting bigger and bigger.
And I think the pandemic sort of accentuated a lot of that. People miss being together with friends. And then also I think the different sort of ways that you can experience Dungeons & Dragons. So you mentioned video games as one, the board game itself, and then people live streaming their games. Something like Critical Role, for instance, where you're watching these amazing voice actors or other people put on a D&D game right in front of you, and you get people who will follow this for hundreds of hours. And so there's so many different ways to experience the game, both from playing it yourself or through other media, that it's become even more popular.
Yeah, I think that that whole streaming YouTube thing is really what kicked it off. That, and like you said, in conjunction with Stranger Things, but a lot of my students have said that their first experience with D&D is watching Critical Role, and that really got them excited about it and got them into playing it.
It's a little bit like sports. You think about you fall in love with sports sometimes by watching people play sports. You know, watching the major leagues, you're like, hey, I want to play baseball. Same thing with D&D.
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
Hey, and so for people at home who have never even once thought about watching strangers play Dungeons & Dragons online, could somebody want to explain what Critical Role is? You know, just give a little bit of a background on this.
It's a spectacle, for sure. To describe it is kind of hard, so please break in. But essentially, it's a bunch of people. I think, how many players are there?
I'm going to be honest. I am probably one of the few people in the RPG space that doesn't watch the show.
I have watched very little, surprisingly. I mean, there's a lot of episodes. But essentially, it's a YouTube show where they get together with their friends, just like you would at home, and play a game. But they have essentially a band of voice actors that are professional voice actors. There's people from Overwatch, and I think there's people from Baldur's Gate, and like all these different games and everything. And so it's these very professional people that are very good at voices and very good at acting out these scenes and everything, including one of them, Matthew Mercer, who's their dungeon master, who's very good at this and very researched and has a lot of games under his belt.
He's one of the main architects of kind of the modern Dungeons & Dragons, right? He's the one who's made the 5th edition and...
Yeah, he made it.
Been
so
kind of the face and voice of the entire game, right?
Yeah, his game called Critical Role is such a spectacle and has been running for an absurd amount of episodes.
Yeah, and they're long episodes.
They're like three, four hours
each. Yeah.
I think The Rock got in on right? Yes. I don't remember if it's Critical Role, but it was one of these YouTube shows where The Rock actually came out as a D&D player as a fan. So that's why it's so big.
But... Yeah, and they make it such a spectacle that it's kind of hard not to like get real. I mean, it's 4 hours long, and they are like basically putting on a play online, and you can tune in every single week to watch them do these. So it's very easy to fall into.
Now, I gotta wonder how much they edit it, because I think that a lot of players go in having seen that and thinking, "Oh, it's just gonna flow like this, and we'll all be able to improv this, and it's gonna be so exciting."
Everyone's gonna use voices.
Yeah.
And then you play, and you're like, "I had a good time. It wasn't exactly the high budget Critical Role that I expected it to be."
But I think one of the things that's important with D&D is that the performance in some ways is secondary. It's the friendships and the relationships you build. And that's, I think, explains the game's continued success. Because a session of D&D, and for those who don't know it, it's not just one time usually you're playing. You're playing it many times over weeks, years sometimes.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so you build these relationships with people. And so it's not like a game of Monopoly, which you play it, you put the board away, and it's done. And so that deep, enduring friendships, though, that develop from this help the game sustain itself and ensures that at times it's waxed and waned in popularity, but you always have a core of people who love it and who will want to make sure that it continues and find new ways to play it.
It draws you back for sure.
Yeah, and on top of that, it's different every time. Like you were saying with Monopoly, it's, you know, the same basic game no matter how many times you pull it out of the box, but you sit down with a new group or even the same group, you might have a different story to play. And so your entire experience with your character and your group is going to be different, and you're going to walk away with different memories. And like you go to any convention around here where all of us tend to gather, and you're going to hear people talk about the crazy things that they do or that they've done with their parties and things like that. So it's constantly new.
I have to think that's part of what inspired the creation of the game in the first place, right? Was some of those early war games, sure, Napoleon could win or lose Waterloo in your game, but Napoleon doesn't leave the battlefield on the back of a dragon, right? They wanted to create a game where you could do anything. And I think that's kind of at the heart of the role-playing game experiences. It is only limited by the imagination and kind of the social contract between you and your friends sitting there.
Yeah, I think it very much was that extension of the imagination thing is that everyone loves, like, these early war gamers were all, like, playing battle scenes, like you said, Napoleon and everything. And then they turned into fantasy battles, and now you had knights and sorceries, and, okay, we can add some myths in there and dragons and things like that. And then at one point, you're like, well, now I have this cool knight. He's got a backstory. And then you start talking about that. And I think it easily flows into creating a game like Dungeons & Dragons.
Natural progression, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that one of the other things that kind of makes this more than just telling the stories is the fact that it is a game and it has the mechanics. And like you said, the every time is going to be different, and it could be different just based on what you've rolled on the dice or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we've actually seen recently, I guess in the past maybe 10 or so years, kind of this uptick in these more like storytelling games, because Dungeons & Dragons is kind of like the quintessential roll your dice role-playing game. But we see a lot of these other games where it's more about this collaborative storytelling between the players, and there aren't really as many roles and there's not as many rules. So I think that the fact that there are the rules is really kind of, you know, it's a game. That's what makes it the game. It's the game with that improv element and that creative storytelling element.
Well, and that's a great moment to turn to this. So if you're just joining us, I'm David Strever. I'm singing for Evan Dawson. I'm here with Sean Boyle, Ira Brand, Ben Duran, and JP Dyson. And we are talking about Dungeons & Dragons and role-playing games. And so for the people who maybe they've been here this whole time, they're still a little bit confused, or maybe they're just tuning in. How do you play Dungeons & Dragons? Can you give a very brief overview, or someone else if you don't feel like the best person to do it.
Happy to do it, yeah.
What's the first game look like for most people just playing D&D? We'll get to the alternative games later.
Well, I guess that kind of depends, because there's now this big push in the whole gaming community for, we usually talk about like session one, the first day of gaming, but now there's this whole talk about session zero, right? What do you do before you even start playing? So, and in the new, I actually just picked up the new Dungeons & Dragons 2024 book, and they have a big section right at the beginning. Here's what you do before you even start playing, right? So they want you now, I guess the community wants to focus more on what are the relationships we're building, what are the characters that we're making, and how is that going to kind of integrate into this whole game that might go for years.
Kind of setting the baseline rules to play together, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are you expecting to get out of it? And yeah, like you said, the rules, the sort of social rules of the game experience. But then your typical game, you've got a dungeon master who is the person who runs, sort of oversees, writes the adventure, sort of sets the players on the path. And I could go into my whole philosophy about what DMing or GMing means, but I won't right now. You've got the dungeon master or game master who sets everything up, and then you have the players, and each player has their own character that they've created within the rules that have different abilities and powers and stats and skills and magic abilities and stuff.
And those are basically a blueprint for what you can do in the world, right?
That's
another layer of rules, is your character, how they can interact with the world is at least influenced by...
Right, Right.
That sheet of paper that tells you what they do.
Right, right. Yeah, so in D&D, they've typically broken it down into you've got your species or your race, which is, like you had said, the humans and dwarves and elves and halflings and all that. And then you have your class, which is these are the things that you can do. So you're a fighter or you're a wizard or you're a druid. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of those that can do different abilities. And then the dungeon master says, here's the situation that you're in. How do you guys want to respond? Who are you going to interact with? And within the scope of the rules, they just move forward, roll dice to solve problems and act things out.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's how I've always played as well. And we actually, back to that kind of social contract, right? So much of it now, especially, I've seen this in the alternative game world. I think there's a perception that D&D maybe has like some bad social dynamics, right? And I think it goes right back to the 80s when there were scare campaigns about Satanism in D&D. And now it's more like, oh, there's a grumpy old man with a beard who's going to be mean to you if you do D&D. And so I think the alternative games have really tried to distance and get away from that stuff and to maybe make some of those social relationships better for the less stereotypical reasons. We have a caller, Emmett in Rochester, who wants to talk about how it can actually help with therapeutic needs. So I'm gonna put them on quickly and then maybe turn that over to you, Ira.
Okay.
One moment. Oh, hi Emmett,
hi.
You are on Connections. What's your question?
Hi, yes. Well, it's more of a comment. This actually goes back to the 80s when I was working in the psychiatric departments for DePaul Mental Health. And I worked there on the weekends, and I would play D&D with the patients who were there. And, you know, we had really nice interactions as a result, but there was one guy in particular who was tremendously insecure, and he would tweak the rules so that he would create demigods that he was still afraid to play because they might get hurt. But he would still come and like, sort of sit at the edges of the game. And eventually, he would, you know, he brought himself in and he was allowed, you know, he was allowing his characters, maybe not himself, but he would start to allow his characters to become more vulnerable. And I could see it was really a way into, you know, imaginative relationships that allowed to like become real relationships.
And let him experience a different version of himself, maybe, right? Kind of play through different scenarios and see, you know, I know there's a dragon in it and there's a dungeon and you're getting gold, but there's some stuff that happens there that happens in the real world too, right?
Right. I could, you know, I can make myself somebody who could never possibly get hurt. Oh, well, maybe it's not impossible that I could get hurt. And slowly it became more of a, like, I want to play. I want to be involved and not just be someplace where I'm invulnerable. And it was fascinating to watch.
That is. And I actually want to turn that over to Ira, who I know is an interest in that. So thank you for your call, Emmett.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have asked for a better, like, example. But there have been some limited studies done where I think National Institutes of Health has a couple of studies out that have found that, like, playing RPGs of any kind have, like, promoted a person's ability to feel empathy, teamwork. And like the caller was saying, you get to put yourself in these very different situations, remove yourself from any anxieties that you might experience, and then sort of have this little bit of like a half step into exposure therapy a little bit. And for some people, that might be enough to help them process a past trauma or, you know, get over something that they've been dealing with in their real life. And also, like, a lot of people in the LGBTQ plus community also have found a home in this space for similar reasons, because they get to sort of leave whatever situation they're in, create the ideal version of themselves, and sort of experience, you know, whatever their brand of queerness is. And so it has a huge benefit.
That's something I've noticed that about the hobby coming back into it after, you know, so we took 20 years off of it. But when I first did it, it was, you know, a very very small subset of society was into it. And then when I came back into it, I saw it was a big space for the queer community. There's a lot of self-acceptance and just kind of comfort within someone's identity that I think is a beautiful part of the hobby. And I think that's maybe part of why it's gone so much bigger than it used to be. Do you think that's fair?
I'd say that's definitely a contributing factor for sure.
And especially with the, I know D&D 5e is, by all accounts, a pretty open kind of accepting environment. But I think some of the alternative games go beyond. You know, there's you alluded to before when you talked about you choose your species in D&D. You know, dwarf is a species. It used to be called race, and a lot of people had criticism about the way that implied a certain amount of bioessentialism. You know, if you're born this way, then you're always this. So they've adapted the hobby, but there are indie games, alternative games that go way beyond what D&D is doing. And I'd love it if either of you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think the beautiful thing about RPG rule sets in general is that there was a point where, like, when D&D was always been the biggest, and right now it always will be, but it could change. And there was a point where there's a game called Pathfinder that split off from D&D. They did exactly what you just said. They were like, hey, I don't like these things about D&D. We're going to make our own. And this has happened a million times, but Pathfinder was kind of the big split from, I think it was 3.5 D&D.
3.5, yeah.
And it split off into Pathfinder. And then Pathfinder became a very big game. They're still going with their second edition, everything. But
Well, and that's actually a great time for me to move to our break. We are going to take a very short break, and then we'll come back and we'll open right up with some of the games that are smaller than Pathfinder even.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, the annual Rochester Reads program is back. The book for this year's citywide tradition is Olga Dies Dreaming by author Xochitl Gonzalez, a novel about the storms we navigate, from weather to family strife, political corruption, and more. We'll talk with the author. In our second hour, we preview Rochester Fashion Week with local designers.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm David Strever, sitting in for Evan Dawson. We are talking about 50 years of Dungeons & Dragons and what's kept the hobby alive for all this time. I am here with Sean Boyle, Ira Brand, Ben Doran, and J.P. Dyson. And Ben, just before the break, you were talking about some alternatives to Dungeons & Dragons and how they've split. You brought Pathfinder, which is a huge game. I think it's one of the ones that's popularly played on the YouTube channels now too. So listeners can go to YouTube and search for Pathfinder actual play or live play maybe and find some examples. But why don't you tell us about some of the more niche games that have come up over time?
Yeah, so Pathfinder was one of those ones that split because there were things that they didn't like about D&D and they wanted to make their own. And the cool thing about RPG rule sets is that that's essentially when people started realizing, oh, hey, I can do whatever I want. Like, I can really make this my game that I want. There was a game that I played a bunch of called Paranoia, which is a very weird game that was written in the early 90s, I think. It might be earlier than that.
These
80s. Yeah, and the reason I don't know that is because I've never read the book. One of my friends played it for us with also never reading the book. And then we started creating this pigeon game along this line of, like, what the parts that we liked about it, these, you know, really interesting parts of it that we found were really cool as kids. And then there was a time where my brother wanted to play a role-playing game. He wanted to play Dungeons & Dragons, and I had, like, 20 books of it. And I was like, you don't have the time to go through. I know you don't. And so I sat down and was like, okay, we can play a game tonight. And I just started winging it. So it was a bunch of stuff that I had known from Paranoia, a little bits of tweaks of rules here and there that I remembered. And I just started playing it off the cuff. Eventually, I wrote it into my own rule set called Deadhalt. It's essentially this same type of thing where it's like, hey, these are the things that I liked. I knew the people that I was playing with couldn't sit down and crunch numbers for a session zero like we were talking about earlier. They just wanted to sit down, talk to each other, and start, you know, role-playing a game together and have some quirky things happen.
What's the premise of Deadhalt? I find so many of these games, like, if you're out there, you can Google lasers and feelings to get what is kind of like the distilled purity of this, which is, there's a game where you have two stats, lasers and feelings, and either you're better at space combat, or you're better at, you know, Han Solo and Princess Leia kissing. So that's the game. That's what it recreates. What's Deadhall inspired by?
So Deadhall, I was living in New York City at the time. I was obsessed with just like mega buildings and things like that. And so Deadhall is essentially a megalithic hotel where you take jobs from the bartender, trying to keep the hotel in check because it is run by a supercomputer, which is very Paranoia-esque. And the supercomputer keeps making the hotel into wildly insane things that is falling apart. So some floors are like sprawling deserts. Other floors are like horrible contortions of the hotel. There's a bunch of weird creatures and everything. And you have to go fix things. So you might just get sent to fix the ice machine on a certain floor, and horrible things happen the whole way, and you got to work through them and all these crazy hijinks. So that was one set of like, hey, I needed something where my players could sit down, I could tell them a very simple thing to do, and everything happens to them on the way there. So go fix the ice machine on this floor. So you go, okay, all we have to do is go to floor 5. And then the story actually happens in between there, rather than writing these very complicated characters that would lend more towards a bigger game like Dungeons & Dragons, Pathfinder, or something like that. Ira wrote a game called Shattered, which is the, I would say, the total opposite of my game, which I will push it straight to you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you. It's actually really cool that we're on this together because we are on both ends of the spectrum. I mean, Deadhall is a zine game, and I have a lot of love for those as well.
And Shattered is gigantic.
Yeah, Shattered is a 300-page tome of stuff. The first 50 pages is just lore of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also part of it, too. Like, there are so many different games out there now that like are like, okay, we like D&D. We like how, to use a industry term, I guess, we like how crunchy it is, or how many numbers you're playing with, how much math you're doing. You know, we like the feel of it, but we want to play it somewhere else. Maybe we don't like, you know, the Tolkien-esque high fantasy stuff.
The kind of pseudo-medieval simulation. Where,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So fortunately, like Ben was saying, you can just kind of take whatever you want and hodgepodge it together into something that you like. I wrote with, was part of a team of 4 other people. And some years ago now, we basically did that. We'd been playing games together, all kinds of different games, from D&D to Pathfinder to a zombie game called All Flesh Must Be Eaten, and everything in between. And we were like, hey, let's, like, we have all these cool ideas of how to homebrew or like make our own custom rules for this. Let's try to build something. So 8 years later, we developed this game that's like this dark fantasy, horror, post-apocalyptic, like just all of our favorite genres, all thrown in and mashed up together.
What are the themes of Shattered?
Oh, well, that's a...
You may have just covered all of them, but...
Yeah, I mean, those are the genres at play, but a lot of it is sort of like we wrote it to be very, very dark and very challenging. It's not, you know, there are some games which are very easy to pick up and play and they remove you from the world. A lot of what we wrote was like, oh no, like we kind of want to doom scroll a little bit and like engage with these challenging things that we all wrestle with in our normal lives, but with a different context.
I think your publisher name speaks
for itself. We published under the name It's Never Dark Enough.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well,
so
I've noticed this, that the, There's this old school renaissance or old school revival movement of D&D where people are going back to the origins, and, and pretty much all of them say, we looked at the appendixes, we looked at the works that Gary Gygax cited at the back of the book, and we said, we're playing D&D all wrong. You know, these rules that don't make sense, it's because I didn't read enough Conan or Fritz Lieber. And once I read that, I realized what he was trying to recreate in this game, and now I have more fun playing it. And so that I've noticed that in the current kind of the modern game design world, people really talk about the influences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'll ask you quickly, what can you name 3 or 4 works of popular art that influenced Shattered?
Oh, well, I mean, for me, that's like, I come from the horror world. So that's like The Hellbound Heart, or Hellraiser, as some people might be more familiar with it, by Clive Barker. Neuromancer by William Gibson. And I'd say, like, going back to a classic like Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. Those definitely influenced me. But when you bring in, like, Ben's game was written primarily by him, so it's a very, like, pure, distilled idea. When you have a team of five people, it tends to get, like, all kinds of different stuff
Baker.
Going on. Yeah.
And then, JP, I want to ask you, you've been playing Dungeons & Dragons for a long time from the bio I saw. Mm. How long have you been playing?
Well, I probably started playing in the late 1970s when I was, quite a bit younger than I am now. And I think one of the things, when you look at early editions of Dungeons & Dragons, especially the original edition, which comes out in 74, at the very end of that, there is a paragraph where it says basically, these aren't all the rules. You know, if it's not here, make it up, figure it out, if you want to share it with us. And Dungeons & Dragons emerges in this time in the 60s and 70s when there's a lot of experimentation going on and role-playing and genre setting and influenced often by these novels and films that you reference. And so there's always been this tension in the history of D&D and role-playing games between the sort of the rules as they're set down on paper and what players bring to you. And you really don't need much. I mean, I remember in long trips with my kids, we'd play and I'd be driving and telling a story and my random number generator were the license plate numbers as they came by. You know, and there were stats, there were no levels, there was just telling a story and engaging people in decisions. And it's this beautiful combination of play and story, which I think make role-playing games so wonderful. And it's like a lot of play, as we talked about before. It becomes a safe place. When you're playing, by default, you're usually in a safe place to explore these different things. And so it's a magic circle in some sense that you're stepping into. But when you step out of it, you're changed a little bit. You're not always sure how exactly, but you've had this time away that somehow changes you a little bit in the process. And that's some of the beauty of it, I think, before. So in some ways, there's always been this tension between people who want to be, well, this thing, you have to do this thing. And other people are saying, no, let's go with the flow. Let's have some fun, roll some dice, and tell a story.
That's great. And we have a caller, Roy in Rochester. Roy, you wanted to share a story about playing games from your past. We'd love to hear it.
Yeah, it was the 1970s in Portland before it became Utopia. I got a room in a house with seven Reed College econ majors, and they were all tied up in gaming, whether it was a deck of cards like nuclear war or trying to, the third floor was the game room. You could lay out an Avalon Hill, whatever it was.
A giant war game.
Yeah. Or, it could say Dungeons & Dragons, hand me the dice. I wasn't the dummy necessarily in the game, but they made me learn a lot. Oh, my God. In fact, one of them went on to become a games tester. He's probably still hanging out at Comic-Con on the West Coast. And somebody else went to study with Milton Friedman, and another one went to Princeton. But I was shocked about the power of gaming, necessarily. And in Dungeons & Dragons, man, I must have had 1,000 deaths.
Excellent.
Just trying to get through the door.
It was rough back then.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Okay.
You know, that made me think of one of the key things about Dungeons & Dragons 2 in terms of its influence is when it comes out. So what else is happening in the 70s and early 80s? We get the growth of the computer. And so as our last caller was just talking about, a lot of people who are in the space, whether they're econ majors like he was or math people, fell in love with Dungeons & Dragons, and a lot of the most prominent early game developers were dedicated Dungeons & Dragons players, and that's really how they learned to do game design. So, for instance, there's a game Ultima, which some people may be familiar with.
Yeah.
It was one of the pioneering online role-playing games, like World of Warcraft. And Richard Garriott, the creator of that, he loved playing Dungeons & Dragons. And so, in fact, in the exhibit, we have dice, you know, the 20-sided dice, for instance, are key to the game. He couldn't get a hold of them back in the 70s. That was hard to do. There weren't game stores in the way there are now. And so his mother actually made them out of ceramics for him to use. We have those on display. He created those games in Dungeons & Dragons, went on to learn programming, create them in the world, and became a massive multimillionaire in the process, but also brought some of that spirit of the game, some of the rules of the game, into the digital space from the analog space.
I expect that's something you see a lot in your research, Sean, with game design, right? That that's kind of the common trend I've heard is we play the game, we love the game, we pick up on how to write the rules, and then we just make it work for us. Is that?
Yeah. It's kind of cool hearing from everybody else here that's really what I hear all over the place too. Is and kind of my story too. It's okay. I've played D&D. It's kind of everybody's first role-playing game. But the one thing that I always try to frame when I'm talking about it with other people is D&D is like the most popular one, and it's kind of the first one, but that doesn't necessarily make it the best one, because everybody's looking for different things, right? Mm-hmm. So you want the grimdark aspects. You had talked about lasers and feelings, you know, real lightweight, more of a storytelling game. There's this big popularity of those really simple, like one pagers.
I played one with my 5-year-old Rigur, a cat.
Mm.
You know, you okay. randomly rolled for what type of cat you are. Mm-hmm. And someone, mm-hmm. I'm sure someone, it was a lot of fun. I'm sure someone wrote this in about an afternoon.
Yep, probably.
I think of Honey Heist.
I was going to mention Honey Heist.
It's one page of like scribbled rules with a like drawing of a bear, and you're just trying to steal honey. That's it.
And you roll for a hat.
Roll for hats.
Bears love hats.
the thing that I think is so great about D&D and just the role-playing games in general is that anybody who's playing them makes them their own, right? The rules are there just as guidelines. They're not, you have to play it this way. It's like you said, they're just sort of there as guidelines. If you have other things that we didn't do, make it up. If you want to add something or change it, go for it. And that's what Pathfinder did. That's what all these other games are doing now is taking that idea of the role-playing game that really did start with D&D and just kind of making it what they want it to be and what their players want it to be.
I don't want to get too deep for the casual listener, but I'll just say that's what I found so interesting reading the history of the early Dungeons & Dragons was it was knights and castles, and then they added wizards, and then they added elves. You know, and these were the same people who published the first thing. They just got bored playing in a certain way, or a player would show up who they never met before, and that player said, well, my Duke is going to be 500 years old, and he's a vampire. So, okay, now we need rules for vampires. But that's so much of the game seems driven by just what a player brought to it.
Well, and to add to that, we have, at least I've noticed in the last, I don't know, decade or so, we've had a lot of interesting games with very unique, like, conflict resolution systems. Not to get too into the weeds on that, but, like, your conflict resolution system is where you roll the dice and see if you pass or fail, if you're successful or not. And there are a lot of games that have been coming out in the last, you know, like, decade or a little bit longer than that that have been, like, incorporating things like Dread with Jenga towers, mm-hmm. using that instead of dice to build tension and things like that.
Anxiety.
Anxiety for sure. Or there's an incredible game called 10 Candles that you actually light 10 candles as part of the mechanic. And as you fail checks, you put one candle out. And once all the candles are out, the game is over.
There's been a big trend towards games where you lose. That's the whole point, right?
Yeah.
There's the trophy line started with Trophy Dark, which is a game where you play, I think the first line is you are a doomed treasure hunter.
Yeah.
And that's it. Your character will die at the end of this game. There's no way out.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite, like, old school, like, going back to basics kind of games right now is a game called Morkborg. And in the character creation for it, it says you can name your character if you want. It won't save you.
And this, I think that's a Swedish game, right? It's a very heavy metal, Swedish, Nordic.
I think they called it like
vibe.
A black metal spiked mail to the face RPG or something like that. It's pretty wild.
It's funny because you can kind of tell that these are very much especially when you get into things where you're intending to lose, you start to realize what makes Dungeons & Dragons in these games very different from other games. It's like, yeah, you sit down at a table, you're like, yeah, we're going to lose this. And you're all like, okay, why are we here? And the reality of it is that because you're there for the story, like the yeah. interest, the things that you like, you yell about years later, like, you remember that time when we, it's usually yeah. like something going horribly wrong. Like, it's usually not like, oh, we slayed the dragon. It's like, remember that time I got eaten?
Yeah.
Like, alive.
I still have jokes with friends from like decades ago that I'll say like, oh, bards make good airstrikes. Yeah. Nobody else understands that, but we immediately yeah. remember that game, that session, and what yeah. happened.
The game is really just a catalyst for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and that's Rob, actually, in our production booth there, sent me a note during this that he has a bunch of soccer friends who, you know, they're watching the soccer game or whatever. If it's not that exciting, they just break out their own little homebrew Marvel Comics World-inspired game with, you know, dice or coins, whatever they have, and they're superheroes with different power levels.
That's awesome.
Oh, that's so cool. Oh,
yeah, and it's a social connection.
Yeah.
Speaking of the social connection, I want to ask, how do people out there get involved? We've got, I know just off the top of my head, there have been a whole bunch of places that opened up from, I think Nirvana is one of them. There's another establishment called Dice Versa, which is right around the corner from our studio.
Yeah, it's right down the street. I haven't been in there yet. I need to.
There's
yeah.
so many of these. Of course, then there's traditional game stores like Just Games and some of these other in the mm-hmm. region. What advice do you all have for people who want to get into the hobby?
So it's easier now more than ever. I mean, sure. locally, we do have Millennium, Just Games, Bulldoze Armory, to name a mm-hmm. few. But we also have like the advent of Roll20, especially over the pandemic, like we were talking about earlier.
Roll20 is a website that yes. anyone can go to and find a game, right?
Yeah, it basically simulates the table and lets you roll your dice and track your characters and all that right there. So it's very easy to, even locally, even if you have friends here, let's say we can't meet up this week for whatever reason. Oh, but I can hop on my computer and play and things like that. So it's very easy to make those connections. But yeah, go to your game stores.
I think my hardest part with games is like a lot of times I don't have a lot of time, and yeah. also I don't have like it stresses me out to set up a big Dungeons and Dragons game. So I like have not played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons like lengthy games. I've played a ton of what we call one shots, which are like, hey, tonight we're all gonna write up characters and we're gonna play a game for 3 hours and then it's going to be done. And some of those end up in the oh. everyone died kind of thing.
I admire your ability to get a game done in 3 hours.
Well, when y'all die, you usually go, okay, it's time. but that's one of those things that there's a lot of smaller games that I would encourage you to just sit down and start playing. You're going to screw up everything, and that's the fun of it.
Yeah.
Because if you try and make it like Critical Role, you're never going to play because it's so hard to achieve that.
And I'd also say for kids, you know, and for parents who might be listening, there's a lot, you know, the Strong Museum, where we have these Learn to Play Dungeons and Dragons libraries will often host yep. sessions like that, schools,
oh, for sure.
their clubs. And so it's you don't need to be an adult to do this. If, you know, you have a kid who you sense, you know, this might be their thing, encourage them to do that, especially through these sort of spaces where the kids can learn how to play and maybe meet some new friends, too.
But I did want to talk at least briefly about kids in Dungeons & Dragons, too, because, you know, like I said, I've introduced my five-year-old to it. One of her favorite games is Ironsworn, which is a grim role-play game about people at a frozen land barely surviving. But you don't have to play it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, she usually plays a small child who has to do some tasks to help her parents. And the rules are very flexible and very simple. It's basically one page. Mm-hmm. They do have a very large book, but the real rules are about one page. And if you throw out a lot of the setting and just go with them, and she has a blast. You know, she only rolls a couple of dice, and she really feels like she's done something and told a story.
I was in New York City a couple weeks ago, and I went into – there was a new game store. It's like a hole in the wall. They had like – five products on the shelf. They had like nothing and like a couple of magic cards. And I went in because I was like, oh, every time I go, I try and see like what else is going on. And there was like 30 kids in there, like children, like fourth grade and under. And they're like screaming like at like One Direction at a guy with a whiteboard. And I was like, what is going on? And he's like, oh, this is the after school club. We're playing Dungeons and Dragons. They are hosting a rock band right now. And so like the kids, and they were having a blast. And so apparently the school is right down the street. And this is just their like after school program where they wait for their parents to come pick them up. And it's like a hallway essentially where there's like 30 kids yelling about how this like rock band is going to do their set and like everything. And it's in this medieval. It was very interesting. And I just thought it was a cool way to set that up.
That's amazing. I would love that for my kid.
So where should people go? Like, of course, feel free to plug mm-hmm. a place that you go, or if there's a local website that someone can go to find someone to play a game with in the area, is there? Do you guys have recommendations?
So Millennium Games, I know, runs Dungeons and Dragons nights. It's in the middle of the week. I'm not
Wednesday.
Sure if it's Wednesday or Thursday. Okay, it's Wednesdays. So I know they do it. I know Just Games holds Dungeons and Dragons things. And those are ones that people can go and say, hey, I want to play a game on Wednesday. They'll pair you up with a group. Maybe a group is missing one player either that night or, you know, they just want to add another person. And then you can start playing. And there's a bunch of kids, like children, that go to those everywhere up to, like, adults and everything.
Well, I know the library has children and adults. Mm-hmm. They have mm-hmm. D&D nights. They have afternoons. So, and that's all the Rochester City libraries. I've seen some version of that on their calendar. I'm sure some of the county libraries do too, because our listening area is pretty far. What about RIT? Do you guys have any things going on there that the general public can pop in on? Or
yeah, I was gonna say pretty much any of the like colleges in the area are gonna have gaming clubs. We've got a few. We've got the RWAG, the Rochester Wargamers Association and Guild, that's just kind of the generic gaming club that's been going for forever. I don't even know when they started, maybe in the 70s or something. But they meet on Tuesday nights in the Student Alumni Union, playing all kinds of different games, but D&D and other role-playing games are there. And I actually host on Monday nights, I host a group within the games department called Crash Test, which is all about playtesting games that students and other people are making. We have local people come in and playtest stuff too. But I have, for a couple of times, I've run some games of the role-playing games I'm working on. I'm teaching a role-playing game course right now where they're designing and publishing games that they are bringing to test there. But we also just spend the time just playing games that already exist. So that's another opportunity. But yeah, I would just second like Millennium, Just Games, and the other stores in the area and just schools in general. There's lots of opportunities out there.
And if you're curious about D&D or role-playing games in general, but you're not actually ready to play yet, what did you guys have recommendations on other ways they can experience the hobby outside of Critical Role?
Yeah, so I mean, that's one of the great things about this fandom is it's really sort of infected every area. You know, if you want movies, you've got the film with Chris Pratt. If you want video games, or Chris Pratt, wrong guy. Anyway,
Chris Pine.
Chris
right?
Pine. The other, yes,
I always get them. I didn't say his name earlier because I knew I said it wrong. So thank you.
Yeah, if you want to play video games, Baldur's Gate is a great introduction to the concepts, and it does all the math for you, so you don't have to worry about it.
What about local theater?
Local stuff. You do have local improv troupe called Nerds in a Basement that does like improv style D&D adventures. You sit down, you suggest some things, and then they go on an hour long adventure. They just had a couple sold out shows at Fringe Fest this year.
I heard so much about them from the local Reddit, which is another place to find D&D players. I found guests for this show through that Reddit.
I've seen a few posts up there of people looking for groups.
There's a lot of people looking for groups on the Rochester
Reddit. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
And with a lot of RPGs and board games in general, just YouTube is a great resource. Yep. If you're not sure how to play something, you know, say, teach me how to play D&D in 1 minute, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah, YouTube,
there's someone out there
sure.
who will be funny and will give you the essence of D&D or any role-playing game that you might want to do. And it's a great way to get into it, especially if you're intimidated by trying something new.
Yeah. I think another way is just looking up if there's a game that you thought is interesting. Hey, like maybe it's Laser and Feelings, and you're like, hey, that sounds like a lot of fun. Watching a YouTube video of people playing it, like you can watch up the rules and like learn it a little bit, and then watch someone play it, and then you go, oh, okay, yeah, this is totally for me. You know, watching the interactions.
And a lot of the indie games that we referenced or name dropped here are totally free. You can just Google Lasers and Feelings and get the PDF. Honey Heist
is also free.
Three Goblins in a Trench Coat is another one.
I play that as well. The cat games, there's two different, at least two different games out there where you are a cat trying to get out of cat situations, and both of those are totally free. Pretty much all of them are one page, they're a PDF, you just download it, print it, and you are, with one six-sided die, you are good to go, right?
Yeah, itch.io has a lot of those. That's a website that they have tons of one-page.
Itch.io, DriveThruRPG is another one where you can find a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I think DriveThruRPG is a great resource for anyone who's looking for any other games. There are a bunch there that are free. There are other ones that you have to pay for. But, you know, like I said, I think that D&D is great in that it opens people's eyes to the hobby, but there are other games out there to check out for sure.
Yeah,
I've had so much fun with the four of you. I originally was joking that if my first show didn't come together, we were just going to schedule you all for noon and then play a game in the second hour. And,
I love it.
I'd be down for that.
Maybe we'll come back and do that. If Evan Dawson takes other day off, I can maybe sneak that one through without telling him.
There you go.
Evan, if you're listening, just don't listen right now. Let me do it. It'll be good, I promise.
I think we'd have a blast.
Well, so in case you're out there and you've just tuned in, we spent the last hour talking about Dungeons & Dragons, role-playing games, why they're so important, why people like them. You can go to the Strong Museum of Play right now. They're doing an exhibit, Dungeons & Dragons, 50 Years of Storytelling, to celebrate the 50th birthday of the publication of the game. And you can also go to our website, wxxinews.org. And I will have an article up there, maybe in about 2 hours or so, with the full episode and some links to resources. We'll put up the itch and some of those others. Thank you so much to all of my guests. It's been really great to have you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to public-supported community media. We appreciate all of you.